Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Today we're joined by Claire O'Neill, who's the Labor member for the Victorian seat of Hotham. Claire O'Neill was the youngest female Australian mayor, and she studied at Harvard's Kennedy School as a Fulbright scholar. She spent time working in Arnhem Land in Aboriginal communities. She's recently released a book which she's co-authored with fellow Labor MP Tim Watts. It's called Two Futures. She and Watts look at what Australia might be like in 2040, if things go badly and if things go well. And they offer some ideas, a few of them quite radical, on how to create a better future. Claire O'Neill, you're in your first term as an MP, and in the introduction to your book you discuss the massive workload of a parliamentarian. So I wonder where you found the time to do this book.
So the context for your question, Michelle, is really important, and that is that Tim and I argue in Two Futures that there are lots of members of Parliament that want to think about the future, and there's a lot of interest in this important subject of long-term thinking, but the day-to-day pressures of our job are very intense, and finding the time to write this book was very challenging for us. So as well as, you know, working very hard in our communities, Tim and I both have really young children, so we've got a lot of family responsibilities. But we just really pushed it to the limit. We worked a lot on weekends and after hours. And during that January period when the Parliament's not sitting, lots of members of Parliament take a break. But we really worked straight through that. And Tim's got some really funny stories about trying to write chapters of Two Futures while he's got kids crawling all over him on his summer break. And there was a lot of that going on. It took us about a year to write the book, and it was just fitting in the time where we could.
And you divided it up into particular areas and each took responsibility for some areas. How did that work? It's always difficult to write a book in collaboration.
It was very much a collaboration. So we split the chapters and Tim wrote on three subject areas and I wrote on three. But we wanted to very much make this a partnership approach. So we carved out whole days out of our schedule and sat together and really nutted out some of the really big problems that we addressed in Two Futures. There was a lot of debate and a lot of kind of very healthy conflict over the ideas. None of it was personal, thankfully. but it's been wonderful to work with another member of Parliament, and I think Tim and I feel that we're really on a journey together here, and we wanted to put some shared ideas down together as a unit.
You've written about the public disillusionment with the political process, which is now a widely remarked upon phenomenon. And you've spoken about being really shocked at the aggression in question time. What can be done about improving the parliament?
Well, firstly, I think it's really important that we tackle this problem, because we talk in Two Futures about how question time in particular is the ground zero of the contempt cycle in Australian politics, and I really believe that to
level.
Be true. The noise level, yeah. So,
tell
mean,
us about that.
Yeah, so Tim's very into his technology and very into his apps, and he bought in an app that's a noise meter, downloaded it onto his phone and brought it into the parliament, and found that at peak times in question time, the noise of question time is equivalent to being 30 metres away from a jumbo jet, 130 decibels. And, you know, it is actually a visceral feeling being in question time and having that aggression just, you know, between the two sides of politics, one against the other. And people react badly to it. I react badly as a member of parliament. And I think there's a lot of us in there that feel a little bit like we're in a system that's designed around conflict. And, you know, is this really the best way to solve the very challenging problems
that
we
have? But do you yell too?
Occasionally I do. Occasionally I do. And I mean, we're very clear in Two Futures. Tim and I are not the Boy Scout and the Girl Scout of the Parliament by any means. But we are a part of many members of Parliament that don't really want to be in there yelling at one another. That's just how the system works. So one of the kind of big themes we talk about in our focus on democracy, which is one of six chapters in Two Futures, is trying to get people back engaged with the parliament. Because one of the things we observe is that the more ordinary Australians disconnect from the process of parliament, the more we see one conversation happening in the parliament and one conversation happening in the Australian community. And that's very worrying. So We talk a lot in Two Futures about ideas for how we can use online engagement, which is thriving and healthy and exciting, and try to connect the discussion in Parliament with that. And we think that by engaging the public more in parliamentary processes, we'll see an improvement to the behaviour, amongst other things.
Mind you, online isn't always productive and healthy, is it? Social media, in fact, one could argue, has contributed to the some of the problems in the political system now because it can get very nasty.
Yeah, people say Twitter's very shouty, which I think is an avid Twitter user, Michelle, you probably feel that a little bit. It's true, but that's only one side of online engagement. One of the things that doesn't get a lot of airplay in terms of discussions about changing media is the really positive side of social media. And as a member of Parliament, I've got the opportunity to engage with thousands of people on an individual level every day, and I do that 99% of the time in a very healthy manner. So I don't think we should allow that 1% of Twitter users to characterise the discussion that's happening online. I think a lot of it is fruitful and quite substantive.
You do talk quite a lot about the media. How much do you blame the media for government's short-term thinking?
I don't think characterising blame is really what we're trying to do in Two Futures, to be really honest. What we see is that technology is changing the economics of journalism, and you have seen it all happen. And we talk about this kind of frantic and fanatical way that media is kind of, I wouldn't say disintegrating, but it's going into certainly different compartments. I don't think the media is to blame. I think technology is changing how things work, and one of the consequences is that we see quality media is very hard to produce these days. It's hard to do it in a way that's economic, and there are some things we talk about that we'd like to see change to help improve that.
Now, you have quite a lot of attention devoted to the question of equality and fairness, and fairness is quite a rallying cry for Labor this term. What do you see as the answer to bringing more fairness into society while maintaining incentives and national competitiveness?
It's a great question. One of the great things, Two Futures looked out to 2040, and when you put that lens on current policy problems, you often end up with quite a different answer than you might look to. So what I'm saying there is that when we think about fairness in the short term, we look very much at the tax system as our solution and the transfers and people's household incomes. But when we think about the long term, the really important question that Tim and I tackle in Two Futures is, our economy is changing profoundly and radically and very fast, and we need to have a really big national conversation about how we can make sure that young people who are being born today are going to live a prosperous life and play a role in a globally competitive labour market in 2040. And the answer to that question is not, I don't think, as much in the tax and transfer system as it is in things like early childhood. So it's fascinating to me how, after decades and decades of research, early childhood still is a little bit at the periphery of the political discussion. When you think about the long-term challenges facing our country and the solutions to them, one of the first things you always come back to, no matter what challenge you're looking at, is early childhood. And one of the things that Tim and I propose in Two Futures is that we have a cabinet minister who is responsible for Australian children, because this is not just about early childhood education, it's also about great parenting and how we can make sure Australian households are all safe, happy learning environments for babies and for young Australians. But we would just like to see much more of an ongoing focus on this issue. When we look at the performance of our system, we're really doing quite poorly when we compare ourselves to OECD countries, and we have to address that if we're going to have an equal and prosperous Australia by 2040.
We do seem to have a paradoxical situation, don't we? We have a lot of talk about the ageing society, and yet we have this problem that high youth unemployment and difficulty at the other end of the working life of older people staying in jobs, and yet people are being told they must work more. What do you think of this paradox?
I think it's an incredibly pressing problem, and it's very important that we have a lot of focus on ageing in Australia. It's an enormous phenomenon that we're going to be dealing with. But we also need to maintain an equal thought to the people who are going to be paying taxes over the next 25 years to support the ageing population. And the distinctive thing about children today is that they don't have a voice. They don't have a voice. They don't get to vote. They don't have a voice in the cabinet. And so a lot of what we talk about in True Futures is directed at younger people. I just say, Michelle, I think something really interesting happened in the last couple of weeks is we had another round of NAPLAN results in Australia that test young people in grades 3, 5, 7 and 9. And another round of NAPLAN results showing us that the performance of our system is stagnating, in fact, declining a little bit when we look at some results. Now, you'd expect that in a country like Australia, where our high-skilled population is at the core of our prosperity, that there'd be an enormous national discussion about what to do about this problem, and yet we get hardly anything. And again, I think this is a big problem. We need to be thinking much more about young people in Australia and how we're equipping them for huge changes which lie on the horizon.
And is this the fault of the education system, or is it the fault of the political system or parents? After all, even though there could always be more money put into education, there's a lot.
Mm.
And yet, as you say, we get these results.
Mm. I think a big part of it is a political culture which is biasing all the time the short-term kind of issues of the day. And I mean, some of the short-term issues that have been detaining us as members of parliament over the last few weeks are essentially important, and I'm not trying to denigrate them or say that they're not important, and we don't do that in True Futures. What Tim and I are just arguing for is that we need to have a conversation about more than one thing at once, and all the while we push one another in the parliament about issues of political controversy, very legitimately, there are huge fundamental shifts going on that no one in the political process is having the conversation about it, and we're trying to create that conversation.
It's part of the problem that we've got to a situation of an excessive partisanship, that we're in a continuous election campaign all the time, that neither side will ever concede that there's any virtue in their opponents. Is this one of the difficulties?
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely see examples of that. I don't think we could, I don't think any politician could claim to dispute that. The partisanship of the political process seems to be getting worse and worse over time. And in True Futures, again, we're just arguing that we need to bring people who are not partisan, who are genuine kind of moderates on both sides of any side into the political process. Just one other idea that we talk about that I think is worth mentioning is around the use of citizen juries. So we see around the whole world and different parts of Australia bringing ordinary people who don't have any axe to grind into the political process to get them to make well-reasoned, well-substantiated judgments about political issues. And I think there's a role for this in an environment where we see a lot of partisanship, perhaps to try to sort of drain that out a little bit of the system.
Now, you both are rather atypical in the Labor Party in that you don't come from union backgrounds, and yet you argue that the unions are more important than ever. If that's so, why do you think people are not joining unions?
Well, so Tim and I have never worked for a union, which makes us a little bit atypical. But the reason that we believe that unions are important to tackling inequality is because that's what the evidence says. And that's where Tim and I are very clear in True Futures. And when we look at studies, we can see that unions are very highly correlated with a more equal society, and the reverse is the case too. Your question's really important, and one of the things I think that the union movement in countries all around the world is really struggling with is how to adapt its model of organising to different workplaces. So what we're seeing all the time is, you know, smaller workplaces, the more sort of traditional blue-collar industries are generally in decline in the countries where unions have been very strong, and it is a very different operating model for unions to organise under those conditions. But there are some unions doing some amazing things, and the National Union of Workers is one of those, which is trying to engage in policy discussions and civil discussions and allowing ordinary people to join the union for a dollar a week to kind of sign up in a more general fight for social justice. And that's a union that's growing. And I think where we see a bit of innovation from unions, we do see that they are rising to this difficult challenge.
We hear a lot about reform, the need for more reform. But as you say, the area of quick wins seems to, or the era of quick wins seems to have passed. And you argue that for the coming generation, it might be the Minister for Childhood Education, for Asian engagement or for climate change who could have a greater influence on long-term growth than the Treasurer. Can you talk us through this theory?
So Tim and I don't believe that reform is dead. There is big policy problems to solve everywhere we look, actually. But some of the kind of quote-unquote economic policy reforms, the things we would really put in that bracket, like floating the dollar or the independence of the Reserve Bank, I think we've picked off the big ones there. And in a sense, those were largely easy reforms, you know, that the cabinet could decide on their own without having to work through a parliament. In Two Futures, Tim Watts and I argue that the biggest economic challenge facing Australia is something that sits a little bit outside the economics portfolio, and that is, by 2040, what are Australians going to be able to do that our Asian neighbours can't do better, faster and more cheaply than we can? And the reason that we're worried about that is because when we look at the performance of our education system, you know, the top seven countries in the world on maths today are Asian countries. And I think we're about 19th on that list. And we've got a real problem on our hands if our assumption going into this region is that we're going to be the smart ones with all the ideas. It's just simply not there in the data. The other thing that we see is that there's been this real sense of fait accompli about Australia engaging with Asia and getting the most out of growth in Asia. But we saw when we looked at this that only 9% of Australian businesses are doing business in Asia, and we're investing seven times as much in New Zealand than we are in China every year. And there's only about 6% of Australian students who are studying an Asian language. So when we look at all these issues, if we've got a sense that, you know, the future's going to be another 25 years of prosperity that we don't have to work for, we've really got another thing coming. And so that's why we talk about, you know, the big reform areas not necessarily being in the economics portfolio, but instead in these kind of adjacent areas of government.
Now, can you just outline the two scenarios you give for 2040 and your optimistic one, your pessimistic one? Start with the pessimistic one.
Well, I think that the starting point for the pessimistic one is that we do nothing about the change machine of our society, which is our democracy. We end up with governments being really unable to make a clear case for reform, and the critical things that need to happen, you know, dealing with climate change, making sure that the engine of our growth continues, things like adjusting to the incredible change that technology is driving through our workplaces, accepting the change of economic and geopolitical powers shifting into the Asian region. And we end up feeling very frustrated in 2040 because we see ahead of us now an era of incredible opportunity, but it's opportunities that won't be captured by coasting. And then if we think about, you know, what can we get out of the next 25 years, there's probably no country in the world right now with more ability to shape its future than Australia. So we talk about a society that's continued that incredible history of innovation in our democracy and is a thriving, exciting, democratic country by 2040, a place where we've really thought about equality, you know, one of the leaders in the world in early education and in the performance of our primary and secondary schools, a place where we've really genuinely embraced the Asian opportunity, and one where we're, helping build a constructive relationship and conversation between Asia and the rest of the world. So we see incredible opportunity, lots of exciting things for Australia, but we do need to think more about the long term and look out to the horizon and think about what challenges lay ahead and manage them well.
It's quite brave to write a book that deals in the future so far ahead, and you point to where people have fallen down in their predictions. Do you ever have a nightmare that in 2040 someone will look at this book and come back and hold you to account?
I wouldn't characterise it as a nightmare because I'm 100% sure that that's going to happen. No, I mean, we're Tim and I are very realistic, and of course we know that, you know, there'll be people poring over every sentence of this book so they can try to whack us over the head a little bit in the parliament. But
well, especially the higher you rise.
Yeah, well, we'll see. But the critical thing for us is that we are not going to let that type of political culture stop us from thinking about and writing down big ideas. We want to be a part of a movement of people in the parliament who are pushing the parliament to think about the long term, to address the big issues that we all know are sitting there, but it seems a little bit too dangerous to touch at times. And so very well aware of the dangers, but we're willing to take them on in order to be the type of politicians we want to be.
So what's the next project, and will that lead you, do you think, to the front bench before too long?
Well, the next project is for me to spend a bit more time trying to be a good parent, and I'm sure Tim feels the same way. So yeah, I guess we'll just see what comes next. I don't think Tim or I are in any type of a hurry, and it's been a huge privilege for us to be able to have the time and space to spend a year thinking about what really matters for our country, looking to the future. And it's an experience I'll be forever grateful for that I started out my political career doing.
We did speak to you in your very early days in the Parliament. Just to finish off, tell us some of your impressions, what surprised you about being a politician, what you've enjoyed, what's quite difficult.
The collegiality of the Parliament, and in particular the Labor caucus, has been a bit of a surprise for me. I think anyone coming in after what happened with the last Labor government would feel the same way. This is a group of incredibly good people who are trying to do the right thing for the country and doing it as a team. And it's been amazing to be a part of that process and be a part of that discussion with the Labor team. And I'm just so proud to be a part of that. In terms of the other things that have surprised me, I think the Parliament is not what I hoped and dreamed it would be in terms of what you hope for a deliberative institution full of very intelligent people trying to do the right thing. It does descend quickly into a bit of bitterness. So that hasn't been that exciting. But what's happening behind closed doors, in a sense, with the committee processes and all the other work that we do as members of Parliament, I just wish the public could see a little bit more of that, because it tends not to be as partisan. We tend to have really good working relationships across the aisles. And I think if the public saw a bit more of that, then we'd have better feelings about politicians in the general community.
Claire O'Neill, thank you for talking with us today. Good luck with the book. And that's all from today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back soon with another interview.